I'm Alan Smale, and I write alternate history, historical fantasy, and hard science fiction. Most recently, and very exciting for me personally, I have Hot Moon, which is my alternate Apollo techno thriller with heart, and that's set entirely on and around the moon.
This is a continuing episode of a series with Alan Smale. The series started at episode 319. Go to the show archive to catch up.
Okay, so I'm going to be reading here from Radiant Sky, which is the second in the Apollo Rising books, from Chapter 2, and we're at the Lunar South Pole with Vivian Carter. It is January the 22nd, 1983, and Vivian is taking part in, she's actually leading the Lunar Geological Survey, which is a team of six people who are traveling around the moon from pole to pole, and they're three quarters of the way around the moon. They're going to be rounding the South Pole and heading up the near side of the moon back to the Zvezda Copernicus base. And so, since this is Vivian, they're just about to come under attack. This is a part of the story which is actually featured on the cover of the second book. Here we go. The assault came just a few hours after LGS-1 turned the corner. They had crawled around the South Pole now, the difficult light angle and the poorly mapped terrain combining against them. They had approached it as close as possible, following the rim of Shackleton Crater to the 30 degrees west line. At that point, they were within a mile of the geographic pole, so to the resolution of the maps they had, LGS-1 was at that moment basically there, with the absolutely true pole just over the crater rim in permanent shadow. "Farther south," Vivian said. 90 degrees within a sneeze. "We did it. Both poles in the bag. Done and done."
"Congratulations, Commander," said Kizemba.
"Me? Nope, it was all of us."
"Go team."
"Go team," Lakontsev agreed wholeheartedly. And that was that, and they kept moving along. They had many more miles to cover that day. From Shackleton, they headed north, but wasn't every direction north now? Passing the much larger Shoemaker crater to their right, and approaching the craggy, rugged, irregular, and equally broad Howarth crater on their left. The lighting was terrible. They tried to keep the MoLab, the mobile laboratory, the rover, and the bike in the oblique sunlight as far as possible, but still had to navigate precariously through pools of deep darkness, following the path they'd laid out months before, using several painstaking physical models of the landscape. And of course, the model terrain wasn't exactly true to reality, but the poles were hard, and everybody knew they would be. But the worst would be behind them soon. Shoemaker and Howarth butted up against each other, their boundary forming another broad ridge. Follow that around, pass beneath another higher ridge illuminated by bright sunshine, and they'd be through the roughest ground and truly back on near side. Earth would soon be consistently above the horizon again. The oblique sun would be a steadily decreasing pain in their asses, and they'd be able to move on more straightforward terrain for 4 or 5 hours before stopping for a rest period and a few hours of blessed stillness, with nothing tilting and jerking and rumbling around them. Vivian was dreading their journey's end. Once back at Zvezda Copernicus, her team had spent 3 days conducting their preliminary debriefing, unpacking the MoLab, and classifying and repackaging the samples and other science data for transport back to Earth. And then Vivian would launch up into lunar orbit for what would likely be her final time. She and Gazembo would rendezvous with Eagle Station and transfer into a command and service module for the ride home. And then what? If this was really Vivian's last trip to the moon, she'd have to find some other passion for the rest of her life, and she had no idea what that might be. Oh well, her dirt bike shift was almost over. Time to get herself back aboard the MoLab and take what passed for a shower. Earth could wait. It was back below their local horizon right now, and comms were quiet once more. Out of sight, out of mind, right? Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. And just as Vivian thought the word evil, it began. In a sharp motion, Andre slewed the rover to the left and shouted, "Danger! Danger!" which made Vivian think briefly, stupidly, of the robot in Lost in Space. Then came the explosion. Vivian's next split-second reaction was, "Volcano?" The moon hadn't been actively volcanic for a billion years, but it sure looked like some kind of small eruption had gone off right in front of the lunar rover, almost between its front wheels, flipping it into the air like a toy. The rover sailed 15 feet off the ground, rose almost vertically, and then dropped back down in lunar gravity slow motion to spike into the ground on its rear end. Dobbs and Lekontsev, both wearing their lap straps, stayed roughly held in their seats as their ride crashed down on its back. She saw their arms flailing, their bodies twisting. The latest NASA lunar rovers were equipped with roll bars to protect the crew from the more ambitious terrain they were required to navigate. The roll bar on the LGS-1 rover had just saved her guys' lives, but it hadn't been able to prevent them from being pummeled by all the rocks and gear that had been thrown at them as the vehicle went over. And the rover was still moving. It bounced a second time, and under that stress, the roll bar twisted and bent into scrap, and the chassis broke in the middle, folding around Vivian's crewmen and obscuring them from her view. And it all happened in that eerie lunar silence. Vivian stared in disbelief and then screamed aloud, "Bill! Andre!" And then both at once, Dobbs and Lekontsev both started bellowing in pain. "What the hell? What the hell?" Vasquez, from the passenger seat of the MOLAB, shouted almost as loud, freaking out at what he'd just seen happen to his partner, Dobbs. Vivian skidded her bike to a halt, looked around her, saw nothing except moon. Gizemba jerked the wheel of the MOLAB left, heading toward the wrecked rover. Vivian tried to cut through the din of everybody talking at once. "Break! What just happened? A mine? A shell? A rocket? What? Christian, quiet! Faye, talk to me!" Whatever it was, Vivian hadn't seen it coming, so she might not see the next one either. Still a babble of voices on her main loop. "Break! Break! Switch to secure radio!" She took a deep breath. "Are we under attack? Here? So far away from anywhere? And why attack LGS-1? Gizemba's voice came in. "Vivian, shooter on the ridgetop. Do you see him?" "No, where?" "Shit!" It came fast from the ridge ahead, almost out of the sun, and almost too swift for the eye to track. Then it exploded just to the left of the MOLAB. This one was definitely a rocket or an explosive shell. The MOLAB lurched right as Gizemba yanked the wheel again. Rocks rained down, not quite reaching Vivian as she came roaring in on the bike from behind. It had come from quite a distance, though, that rocket. The top of that ridge was a ways away, a good 400 yards. The accuracy of a shoulder-mounted rocket wasn't terrific, and infrared homing devices never worked a damn on the moon in daylight because everything was hot. But that first explosion hadn't been a rocket, meaning there could be more mines. Crap. The hostiles had chosen the perfect time and place for the ambush. They were constrained to the channel they were in, canyon on the left of them and that rocky scarp to the right. Narrow throughway in between. Her convoy could go forward or back, and that was that. Stop thinking. Move. Vivian twisted the accelerator on the dirt bike to maximum, and it leaped, coming adrift from the ground as the wheels spat gravel, and eventually made proper purchase and propelled her forward. Ahead of her, the MOLAB was still on the move. "Gizemba, you're driving toward the shooter." "Yeah, what? You want me to stop? Can you turn around?" She eyed the terrain. Doesn't look likely." "Not in one go. I'd need a three-point turn, making them an obvious sitting duck for the next rocket. Bad idea." But there were no good ideas that Vivian could see. "Okay, but don't take the easy road. Drive a road that looks like crap, that no one could ever get a MOLAB through it. Less likely to be mined. Go over rocky ground, use the slopes, and keep your eyes peeled." "What about Bill and Andre?" Vasquez cut in, shouting, clearly ragged. "What about not dying?" Vivian snapped back. At the same time, Gizemba said, "Chill, man. We'll get to them. Never fear." Vivian had already cut off Dobbs and Lekontsev's channel so she could talk around their cries of pain. She couldn't even think about them right now. Maybe she'd have reacted like Vasquez if it was Ellis Meyer who'd just been bombed and was pinned underneath a rover, but priorities. "They're alive and conscious. They'll keep. We need to take these guys out first." "Take out?" Vasquez again. She ignored him. Faye put in a stress call on repeat on the Houston loop. 10-4, said Gizemba. "How long did it take to reload a rocket launcher?" "Longer than this, apparently. Or maybe their attackers knew the MOLAB was just about to drive over a mine anyway?" Cold fear flooded Vivian's spine. Vasquez wasn't done yet. "Take out how, exactly?" "God's sake, Christian, hush up and patch me through on the S-band and start a recording. And while you're at it, start cameras and voice tapes." So they start the Mayday. And Vivian's thinking all this time, Were the Soviets really firing on LGS-1 with two of their own people aboard? Hopefully the suits have protected Bill and Andre from the worst of the impacts. From the quick glance, Vivian could see them still moving, maybe trying to squirm into position where they could get the leverage to lift the rover off themselves. In the moon's gravity, it would weigh less than 100 pounds, but pinned as they were, it would be a challenge. Fortunately, the rest of Vivian's crew was inside the MOLAB, and its radiation shield might help a bit as armor against explosive shells. Vivian, on the other hand, was out in the open, but not defenseless, at least in principle. She swung the bike around, put the hammer down, and headed for the pod, which is behind the MOLAB. Her wheels skidded, too much torque, too little care, and as she slid left, she jammed her leg out to keep herself upright. Her boot bumped painfully across regoliths, sending shocks through her ankle and her calf. She wrestled the bike back under control. "Faye, I'm coming up alongside." "Need me to slow down?" he asked anxiously. He knew what she was up to. "Nope, keep her strength and shore for a moment." Tracer rounds swept the terrain in front of her from left to right. Bullets? Shells? She couldn't tell, but she was through and past them before she even had a chance to react. She'd seen the sparks as they ricocheted off the MOLAB, though. If that first blast had been a mine, they had to have planted it long before LGS-1 came over the horizon. She came alongside the storage racks on the trailer. This was the tricky part. Still at speed, still bumping along the uneven surface, Vivian had to choose a moment to take her right hand off the handlebar. She reached up, banged on the side panel to flip it open, and reached in to grab her M132 and the associated munitions pack. Into the basket on the bike they went, and off went Vivian, punching up the gas again in her electric-powered bike. The M32 Viper was a small, shoulder-mounted rocket launcher designed by General Dynamics for use in vacuum, made of fiberglass with an extensible tube and pop-up sights. On her previous sidetracked lunar mission, hostile Soviets had shot at Vivian on at least two occasions with their equivalent of one of these. It was long past time Vivian returned the favor. Now Vivian was armed and, with luck, dangerous to people other than herself. All she had to do was to kill her attackers before they killed her. Vasquez's voice cut in again. "All business now. Guys, check behind. More hostiles on our six." "Seriously?" Vivian was driving so fast that looking back over her shoulder was a risk, and she hardly wanted to stop. Instead, she kicked the bike left, swung it around in a 360. A tight loop brought her close to the crater rim. Sure enough, far back, several hundred yards away, shining and moving fast and difficult to see, a rover of some kind. This damned sun-slant lighting was a pain. Bad enough during normal operations, hopeless in an emergency. "Confirm, hostiles on our tail," Gizemba swore. "Looks like a lunacod, like it would be anything else," Vasquez muttered venomously. "I'm going to have to turn anyway," Gizemba said. "Gets even narrower ahead. If not, I'll have to slow down and become an easy target for the shooter." "Wait, shit," Vivian scanned the terrain again. "You don't have the room for that," says you. "Got to keep moving, and we got to be head-on by the time that lunacod gets here." Head-on. So here goes. The MOLAB lurched to the right, heading straight towards a wall of rock. "Holy cow," Vivian said.
If you enjoy listening to Sci-Fi Thoughts, but find it difficult to remember to check the website for new shows, get this technology from the future! Install into your phone a podcast player. Using this, you can subscribe to our podcast feed. And next thing you know, you'll be cruising around in your car with your phone plugged in, playing Sci-Fi Thoughts, or you'll be out there jogging, or you'll be doing whatever you want to do.
Please put the podcast player down.
And have your ears plugged into some cool science fiction programming. You can find instructions on LancerKind.com. If you're listening to this show in a podcast player, you will find show notes that zip right into your device. If you don't have a podcast player and you want to see the show notes, go back to where you downloaded the MP3. This is a continuing episode. The series started at episode 319. So if you want to catch up on some episodes you missed, go to the scifithoughts.space and you will find a search box and you can type in whatever episode number you wish and it will find it for you. Next episode, more Alan Smale.
When Alan was doing his reading, he did some very key things because he works around mics a lot. And I thought to myself, why does he know to tilt his head back when he delivers this loud part? And I realized, oh yeah, that's right, the chromatics. So Alan, tell us a little bit more about the chromatics, the band you're on.
Yeah, sure. The Chromatics were a six-person singing group. So there's three men and three women. We've been around for some time, actually. We've been singing together for over 25 years and mostly with the same personnel.